Still John, still compulsive eater, afternoon session continuing.
Hi, John.
I just want to mention, hopefully the Ask It Basket is still somewhere and still going around, just in case there are other questions that will come up, like while I'm talking about whatever is going on. I think we'll just leave those in there. What I'm going to do is I'm going to do some more. Let's see, it's a little before 5. And then I'll grab and see what questions I have, and then we'll open up for sharing until dinner time again. So,
wow, an hour.
An hour. And again, okay, so we're going back into talking about character defects and things like that. And again, I mentioned one of the things I was big at also was that whole playing a victim and getting that you poor thing kind of situation. And, you know, again, I look later, a mature person doesn't have to do that, but I would. And I also tended to seek out people that I think in some ways would abuse me so that I would then play the victim. I don't know what that was about, but I heard somebody say recently they now avoid red light relationships and red light people. And I thought that was wonderful. Self-righteous anger, the number one offender for me. Boy, when somebody did something wrong to me and I knew for an absolute fact I was right, that allowed me to just pull off all the stops and just go nuts. And, of course, totally overreact to whatever happened. Because a lot of times, because I was an angry person, it gave me a wonderful outlet. You know, I used to say, before I did work, it wasn't just anger at specific things. I always said I walked around 5 degrees off of boiling. You know, now I could put on a good face and I could seem like the happiest, as long as that temperature didn't go up 5 degrees. But boy, I could turn on an instant because I was so angry, and bang, I would go off to the races. And that's one of the things that had to change. And one of the things that has changed me, because I realized today there is a cost for my serenity. There's a cost for my stomach acid churning, you know. Then the line that I love that I learned in the other program, how important is it? I've gotten so much better at stepping back and going, how important is this thing I'm getting all cranked up over? You know, another great line I heard one time at a meeting, and boy, it stuck with me. I heard about a year ago, somebody said, if you have a problem that can be taken care of with the writing of a check, you don't have a problem. And I was like, wow, what a concept, you know. Now, again, that sounds good if you've got money, but I think of how often I would get churned up over something where I go, you know, I can just call somebody and they'll take care of it. I don't want to spend the money because I'm a cheapskate, but you know what? My serenity is worth more. And it sort of changed how I looked at things. The other line I got from Al-Anon, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy, you know. I said that to a sponsee one day who was a lawyer, and he said, well, what if the only way I can be happy is to be right? And he was like, wow, you are a lawyer, aren't you? But I had to be right in my family. And I'll tell you why, because in my family, if you admitted that you weren't right, you became a target. You know, so I had to defend that I was right, no matter how convoluted that thinking had to get, that rationalization and justification. Well, you know, you did that to me. That's why I had to act like an idiot. You know, and today I don't have to do that anymore. The other thing I heard a lady say, you know, talking about anger and stuff like that, said her sponsor told her, you are not allowed to have arguments with people who are not currently in the room. Shucks. But again, that's that giving people all that rent-free space in your head, you know, then they're not thinking about me, they're not caring about that, and I'm just churning up over it, you know. But one of the worst traits about this stuff is it made all these character defects and stuff, the way I thought about things and the self-centeredness, it made me terminally unique. You know, it made me terminally unique. And the problem with that is I was no longer teachable. You know, I would hear somebody have a problem and I'd be like in my head, well, yeah, that's you, but you're not as smart as me or this or that. And today I don't feel that way anymore. I can be teachable. You know, when I think about, you know, the people who've who are no longer here that died as a result of this disease. And like I said, Murray and other people like that, today I can go, you know what? If that can happen to him, it can happen to me, because he was even smarter than me and he's dead. And if that can happen to me, if it can happen to them, it can happen to me. So it helps me change, because the old me being terminally unique, oh, whatever hack guy had, it's not going to happen to me, you know, and it's an important, you know. The other thing I heard a long time ago is an intelligent person learns from their mistakes, but a person with wisdom learns from other people's mistakes. You know, here I am, a smart person, but if you told me, oh, don't put your hand on that thing, it's really hot, I would have to go, ow, you're right, you know, instead of trusting that or learning from other people, you know. The other thing, you know, I would cross off so many people who I'd listen to because of whatever possible a prejudgment I had about them. And there's a great line from Confucius that says, a wise man can always learn from a fool, but a fool can never learn from a wise man, you know. Meaning, if I can be teachable, I can learn from anybody, you know. Because I remember I was at a meeting once, and there was this guy we had in the meeting. And he, how do I put this delicately? Well, we have a slogan over, at least where in my area, we have a slogan in AA where we go, problems other than alcohol, meaning he sort of had problems. And when he shared, he'd get up and he would just go off on God knows, you know, people on the moon could understand him, but we would be like, okay, he gets 3 minutes. But one day I came into the meeting, it was like a Sunday morning meeting, and I was like half asleep, and, you know, I just was sort of not my usual, whatever, sharp, cynical jerk. And the guy, he gets up to share, or he shares, and he said the most brilliant thing that I needed to hear that day. And I walked out, and he all of a sudden hit me. You know, if I had been my usual self and not half asleep, I would have turned him off. And I wouldn't have heard that thing I needed to hear. And it sort of taught me, you know what? I can learn from anybody if I'm willing to be teachable and just be willing to listen to what is said, not listen from whom it's said that I might have some prejudgments about. And it sort of changed how I looked at things. Another one of my defects is what we now in these days call control issues, you know. And again, part of that was being the child of alcoholics. I had to hold things together. In a lot of ways, I was like 8, 9 years old. I was in a lot of ways holding, you know, some of the household together because of a parent who had no ability to do some of that stuff herself. So control for me is safety. The lack of control is, like, I remember a therapist saying it's like life and death. And I had to learn that I'm older now and things have changed. I remember when I was talking at one point to a therapist about how I had so much trouble with emotion and still being terrified of emotion. And he said to me, he says, well, you know, you've got this from a time when you were this big and the emotions were this big, you know, low and high. And the difference is now you're this big and the emotions are like this big and you can handle them. And it's the same with control. I don't have to hold on to the control now. It's not a matter of life and death. I can let other people make decisions. And guess what? Some of them, they may do things that I don't agree with, or they may do them in a way. For a short time I was a boss, and I was the most terrible boss you could be, because I couldn't delegate to let people do things and let them do them their way. Not only did I want them to do it, they had to do it exactly the way I told them to, and it makes for a lot of pissed off employees and a lousy boss. And and part of that was just my control issues. Fear of the unknown was another one I couldn't stand. Fear of the unknown. If something was up and it was either going to go my way or go against me, I'd rather have it go against me than to take a long time and have me in suspense. That was just almost intolerable for me. And that's one of the things I had to learn is I am not in that house anymore. I am not the person that I was, and I can cut that thread through time, because I think we walk around a little with the thread that goes back, you know, over now. They talk about, you know, anything that's hysterical is historical, you know, meaning if I'm finding myself overreacting to something, it's probably really not about that. It's about something that goes way back, and it reminds me. I'll tell you one of the ones that gets to me. If if something's come up, let's say it's a group conscience or something, and I get the, or it's something, I want you to agree with me, and I give you my whole spiel, and you say, yeah, I don't agree with that, we're not going to do it that way, I'm fine. But if you come up, if I go to say something to you and go, I don't want to hear about it, and you dismiss me, I start, you know, steam comes out of my ears. And I can look at, it has to do with my childhood and, you know, not counting for anything. And my mother moving all over the country and not caring about whether how I felt about her or any of those things. I didn't get a say in anything. And so that it happens to be one of those things. Now, I don't have to act that way anymore. You know, I can be the adult now and change that, but I got to realize that, you know, this is an old psychological thing. Child is the father of man, but it doesn't have to be. I don't have to be in the family situation anymore. And at the same time, you know, I shouldn't get into that analysis paralysis they talk about. You know, what am I going to do about it today? Not the way they do it. They did it. One of my favorite little pieces of literature, it's from AA, and for those who don't know, all AA literature is conference approved for OA. It's a pamphlet called The Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what it is it was written by this guy, Alan M., who was actually from down in my neck of the woods. And he was a psychologist who was also a longtime sober person who was giving a talk to a group of people that were graduating from UCLA and doing about substance abuse. And he was trying to explain to laymen a little about about AA and about the big book and all that. And all essentially this is sort of a restatement of the concepts in the big book, but in a more, modern way of talking about things. And I just love some of the things it talks about. I want to just read a couple of these things. He says, Alcoholics Anonymous consistently emphasized its conviction that alcoholism is, to use its own phrase, a symptom of deeper problems. However, AA also believes that the cleverest diagnosis of these troubles is of little benefit if the patient dies. You know, it says... the next line is my favorite. It says, autopsies do not benefit the person upon whom it is performed. Sometimes sooner, sometimes later, AA seems to get over to its neophytes that total abstinence, and that's the word he uses, total abstinence is the name of the game. In AA, the cart does come before the horse. The first step is still the first step. No newcomer to AA is ever left with any real doubt that recovery can only begin with the decision to stay away from the first drink. But the main part of that, it's sort of reinforcing what I said about you got to put the substance down, but also about that analysis paralysis, that autopsies don't benefit me. It's sort of nice to know some of these things, but it's not. I got to be careful not have it, hold me back from changing, you know, just because some of those things happen to me. And some of the things, again, some of the things we learned growing up, and we had years and years to learn this, we have to now take years and years to unlearn. This stuff, I'd love it if I could just, that's it. I want all my character defects taken away, but that's the reason 6 and 7 are two discrete steps, is, you know, I want to have them, but I realize that only my higher power is going to lift them. But I have to at least make the effort to try and meet my higher power halfway and at least, you know, minimize some of that in the short term. And also part of this control issues has to go back to my character defect of ego. I know better than you. I'm so much smarter than you. And it isn't just fear, but, you know, it's some of that too. You know, I want to change things. The other great line I heard, once a year, the Oakland Intergroup has a thing where they go through the steps, and I got, you know, I was asked to work on it. But this woman got up and was talking about control issues, and she said, my sponsor told me, other people are not imperfect versions of you. And I thought about how often I tended to want to make them perfect versions of me, you know? And I can identify with that. The other thing I heard somebody say once is, do God's work, not God's job. You know? And it was an important thing to remember. You know, and the thing is, though, is that, you know, I do have a lot of experience in a lot of things. And maybe some of the things I would suggest are valid and maybe could be helpful. But I have to be careful about wait till I'm being asked about my opinion on things, not to go up all the time and pressing what I think you should do all the time. And that took a long time. And it's probably the thing that's hardest for me and I'm imperfect about, you know. I couldn't get that. The other thing, and talking about the other imperfect versions of you, one of my favorite paragraphs is on page 417 in the big book. And when you say 417 in the big book, everybody goes, oh yeah, I know the acceptance paragraph, which is a wonderful thing in itself. But I also love the paragraph that comes right after the acceptance paragraph. And let me read it. It says, Shakespeare said all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. He forgot to mention that I was the chief critic. I was always able to see the flaw in every person and in every situation. And I was always glad to point it out because I knew you wanted perfection just as I did. AA and acceptance has taught me that there's a bit of good in the worst of us and there's a bit of bad in the best of us, that we are all children of God and we all have a right to be here. When I complain about me or you, I am complaining about God's handiwork. I am saying I know better than God. And, you know, that was such a profound thing, because one of the things that I did the worst was I was incredibly judgmental. I was judgmental about everybody. You know, I could look around the room and especially if I've been to meetings, I'm going to tell you what's wrong with each and every one of you, you know. And the reason, the problem with that is, of course, the person I was doing that most to was myself, right? And I would read that line sometimes about perfection, about judgment at meetings, and I would make it all about, when I'm criticizing you, I'm criticizing God's handiwork. But that's not what that sentence says. That sentence says, when I'm criticizing me or you, I'm criticizing God's handiwork. I got to realize I'm exactly where my higher power wants me to be today. And when I think of it a little differently that way, I can sort of take the foot off the back of my own neck and quit damning myself and beating the crap out of myself, because I am not the perfect person, you know. And that was so hard for me, because I don't know how many years ago, I would I'd be reading, you know, the thing about the in the 10th step in the big book, try and find that in a hurry. You know, where it talks about, was it page 84? I didn't put a thing in on page 84. Where they talk about the 10th step and, where am I going to find it? You know, where it starts listing all these things that about, you know, how the day was, you know. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something from ourselves? Were we kind and loving to all? And I'd be sitting there listening to that going, nope, 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 didn't do that. Nope, nope, nope. And I would really beat myself up. I'm like, you know, you've been in program all these years and you still got all those things. And I would really beat the crap out of myself. Instead of realizing, and I say this to sponsees now, all the stuff we've been talking about, all the stuff that's in that book and in these steps, these are ideals toward which we strive and never hit. I don't care who I've talked about that I have admiration for. They're, you know, my favorite line that is stuck with me, my buddy Harlan always says, he says, I don't care how long you're in this program, how much you memorize every word of that first 164 pages of the big book, no matter how you do all of that, we don't rise above the level of human being. And on any given day, with all this recovery, we can still fall flat on our face in terms of how we act. And it happens today. I don't like it. I don't want to be that person. I try as quickly as I can to realize it and make amends. But I think at least I've taken a little bit of the stick away from myself about that and go, well, that wasn't exactly, you know, great recovery. Let's see if we can change that. But not, oh, you're a horrible person. Haven't you learned anything in your, you know, years in program? And to realize that that doesn't happen that way. The other thing for me, that's one of the most dangerous character defects for me, is cynicism. Cynicism and intellectualization, you know. The longer I'm in program, and the more a lot of times I'll get up at a retreat and say, you know, I want to apologize right off the bat because you guys should have heard me 10 years ago. I had all the answers then, you know, because there were so many things I was absolutely sure of about program that I come 180 degrees on now. And once you start to have that kind of thing happen, you no longer speak with the certainty of things when I was in my 20s and 30s. I know what's right. Now, I'll say, here's my opinion. I think this is right. I may be wrong. I love that line from Al-Anon that they always say. When you're having a disagreement with somebody, you just look and go, you might be right. You know, the subtext on that, the unspoken words is, or you may be an absolute damn idiot, you know, and totally wrong. But you may be right. It allows you that wonderful open thing. You know, but going back to the cynicism, when I drill down on that cynicism, I realize what really is at the bottom of that is fear, you know. And mainly fear of unknown, you know. When there's something I really don't understand, I tend to poo-poo it. You know, and make jokes or roll my eyes about it, and part of that is because I'm working hard to not be this, but I always joke that I have the trifecta of cynicism. Okay, I'm an alcoholic comedian New Yorker. You know, you don't get any more cynical than that. You know, but when I look, I realize that some of these things I'm poo-pooing and rolling my eyes about are things that I just somewhere down here I don't understand. Or they threaten me in some way. I'll give you the perfect example. This to me was the ultimate of, I would roll my eyes and go, oh God, please give me a break. There was a time back, years ago, we've gone through some crazy times. A lot of you guys haven't been around long enough. Anybody here an old timer remember when people were bringing their teddy bears to meetings? And I was like, oh my God. But it was part of what would happen. But the other one that really made me roll my eyes was positive affirmations. I would hear that and go, oh, for God's sakes, give me a break. You want me to go stand in front of a mirror and go, you're a good person, gosh darn it, and people like you, you know? I would just roll my eyes at that. But I look and thought about it as I went in program. I go, you know what? I poo-poo that. But I have no trouble buying all of those negative affirmations I have about myself that I have had for a long time. And you know what? I got these over years, and they got into my system, and they over a long period of time. How the hell am I going to get rid of them if I don't try to change that story? And some of that might be, maybe this might work for me. So instead, and I realize that's another one of those little arrows in my disease's quiver to use against me to get me to not consider things by being cynical and intellectual and rolling my eyes. When maybe something like positive affirmations, and I did start doing a little of that. I mean, I wasn't crazy about it, but or at least to say, hey, you know, you did okay there. You know, okay, you had a good day. Or some of that stuff that I never did. I would only, you know, I was at an AA meeting once, and this guy said it was absolutely perfect. He says, you know, in my family, if I came home with a 99 on a test, my father had say, how come you didn't get 100? And then if I came home with 100 on a test, he'd say, how come you didn't do that the last time? You know? And at a certain point, I grabbed, you know, a lot of these things that happen to us as children, at some point, we it's almost like one of those relay races, and that baton, you know, in slow motion, you know, like Chariots of Fire, that baton of all that crap goes from our parents to me, and now I'm running with that baton. And how am I ever going to change that if I don't make an effort to realize, you know what, I got to get rid of these old tapes, or I'm never going to get better, I'm never going to be happy, and I could end up back into relapse and going crazy. I'll be that smart-ass, cynical, 600-pound guy in the back of the meeting, and I don't want to do that today. Dishonesty. I tend not to be do dishonest things today. I tended to do them a lot when I was newly sober. But one of the things I realized as I went along, that this, when I do anything dishonest, it just doesn't make me feel good anymore. That's, you know, OA, in addition to ruining your eating, and OA will ruin your eating. You're never going to be able to do it absolutely without any thought anymore. But 12-step program will ruin some of your really bad behaviors, because, you know, some of my think I might have been clueless about before, and now I can't do that, you know. The other thing about it is, I heard somebody say, I don't want to eat today, you know, I don't want to binge today, but I also don't want to eat today, you know, and that's where these steps help me, that I won't want to do that. And I know that what happens is things change in you as you go along. I have a brother who's he's a born-again Christian, and we were driving along one day, and he starts going, well, you know, because of this thing, it says in literally chapter and verse, you know, it says in Matthew 1:14, blah, 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 and then he was going on about some other bad behavior, and, well, you know, it says over in Luke, blah, blah, blah. And finally I went, Bob, you know what, I'm in a 12-step program, we don't have all these chapter and verses, we just have this really little annoying thing that gets in here, that when you do something wrong, you just go, oh, shouldn't have done that. Or I shouldn't do this. Doesn't mean I always listen to it, but I can no longer just do it with impunity anymore. You know, I just know this isn't the right thing to do. And sometimes I'll do it anyway, but it starts eating away, and then usually I have to reverse whatever it is I did, because it's what gets in there. It's almost like an implant that just sits there and starts buzzing, going, you're doing something dishonest, or something like that. And, you know, and really, what's it worth? Is it worth my serenity? Is it worth whatever? Maybe it's something that would give me financial gain, but it doesn't work. And, you know, to quote my brother, what profit a man to gain a fortune and forfeit his soul? You know, I want to be happy and joyous and free, and I can't do that if I'm doing dishonest things. And intellectual dishonesty, too. You know, not speaking my truth. And going back to fear. Oh, people won't like me if I say something. You know, and fear of confrontation, of not talking about what I need, you know. We have this problem. We've been having this problem down in with some meetings where people, you know, one of the things I found, a lot of people in program have an intense fear of confrontation, you know. So something will happen in a meeting. Or somebody will start doing something in a meeting, like wearing too much perfume, right? And instead of going up and saying, you know, could you possibly not wear that much perfume? No, we're going to go put in the format, you shouldn't wear perfume, you know, and put it in the format. Now, the person who's wearing the bad perfume, they leave next week and we never see them again, but now it's in that format forever, you know, and the format gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, because instead of just going up and saying something to somebody, and I heard somebody say, you know, the real key is communicate, don't legislate, you know, meaning, you know, try and be willing to go up and talk to somebody. But again, part of that was my fear. I tended to do some of that too, you know. And the other thing was, you know, one of the reasons I don't want you to not like me too, that external validation. I want external validation. If I say something, you know, I think you're not going to like, you won't like me, and I won't get that external validation. And why was that such a big thing? Because there wasn't any internal validation. You know, there was not enough of me in there that cared about myself enough, you know, and I'll actually talk about that tonight a little. There was no internal feeling that I'm all right just the way I am. And that's the thing that's slowly coming to me. And I'm talking years and years and years of going, I'm okay just the way I am. And dishonesty in relationships, I'll talk about that tonight too. Perfectionism, again, you know, I mentioned that earlier. You know, if I couldn't do something perfectly, I don't want to do it at all, you know. And the reality is, I'm never going to get to do something perfectly if I don't do it imperfectly first, you know? There was this great line from the TV show West Wing once where they had a Mars lander that you know, they were going to do this whole press thing with, and all of a sudden they lost it and it didn't work. And the person said, you know, in the history of everything that's worked, there was a time when it didn't work, you know? And it's sort of true that, you know, if I'm not willing to try stuff and not have it work, I'm never going to get to the point where it works, you know? I mean, it was, I, I'm as guilty of this as anybody. A couple of years ago, I wanted to learn how to play the piano, you know? And one of the things is, as a student, I was always, I would grab stuff and be really fast. I was always, you know, I didn't really have to do much homework because whenever they were talking about it went in and it stuck, I was way ahead of everybody else in that respect. Well, when I got into playing the piano, it's not a mental thing at all. It's a physical thing. And I am a normal person. I don't think I was any worse than anybody, but I couldn't be at the head of my class on that, and I gave it up. You know, and I look back and go, you know, you shouldn't have done that. You should have been willing to sit there and plod along and make mistakes. But that fear of not being perfect made that really hard, you know. And part of that, you know, that perfectionism is in a lot of ways, it's, you know, it's immature thinking. You know, life isn't black and white. You know, life isn't even gray. It's got a million colors. But part of me wanted to make everything black and white because it made things simpler. And they're just not simple in life. And I need to remember that, you know. And my disease wants to convince me if I'm not working program perfectly, why bother, you know. And part of this, I look back, was part of this came from, I ended up being a latchkey kid at an early age because my parents were sort of out of it. You know, I went from a mother who was a real low-bottom alcoholic to a father who was what they call a functional alcoholic. And he was a car salesman, and he would, like, drop $5 on the counter and say, here's money for dinner, and I wouldn't see him for the rest of the day. So I essentially raised myself. And, you know, we don't let kids raise themselves in society. You know, if something happens to a mother and a father, then we don't let the 13-year-old raise the 11 and the 9-year-old. Not because maybe the 13-year-old may know enough to do it, but they're not emotionally mature enough. But the trouble was, is I sort of raised myself, and I was an emotionally immature kid, and I knew two things. I knew I was either perfect or I was shit, you know? And that went in, and I carried that for a long time. Instead of being a mature person, I look, and I don't have kids, but if I did, I think I'd like to say to my kid, if they're trying something and failing, okay, well, that didn't work out, you failed. It's okay. It's okay, you try again. You may want to do as best as you can, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't always happen that way. But I had this immature thinking from childhood, and I was carrying that into adulthood. You know, and the other thing about the perfectionism, it was okay if you weren't perfect, but it wasn't okay if I wasn't perfect. And part of that was because of my upbringing. I had, because I didn't think enough of myself, I needed to be perfect to prove to you I was as good as you. I didn't really care if I was better than you, but this way I could at least feel I was as good as you, because deep down I didn't think so. The other thing I did is procrastination, right? I tended to procrastinate because, you know, God forbid I shouldn't get whatever it is perfectly, I'll put it off. And this is like one of those few places where I disagree with something that's in AA literature. In the AA 12 and 12, it says procrastination is sloth in 5 syllables. I don't think it is. I think it's fear in 5 syllables. You know, I think it's fear of either not doing it perfectly or not, you know, a failing or whatever. Because here's the thing about procrastination. As long as I don't do it, I can fantasize it as having been getting done perfectly. And that will always be the ideal. As soon as I start to actually try to do it, now there's a chance it won't be perfect. It'll always be less than whatever it is I was fantasizing while I was procrastinating on it. And one of the lines I always say to sponsees, I have one sponsee who was trying to, you know, he was single and he was trying to meet somebody, but he wasn't putting himself out there, you know. And I said, you know, you guys have all heard the expression, faith without works is dead. Well, I have another one. Plans without action is fantasy, you know. It wasn't, you know, he had plans of what he was going to do, but he didn't. He was a fantasy. And I had to be, you had to be able to, you know, go out and do it, you know. The other thing is I would shut off people that would say something that I disagreed with. Or maybe they said something was a little nutty at meetings, you know. Somebody who I previously thought was okay all of a sudden did something. And then I was like, okay, well, my opinion to you is totally gone now. Instead of realizing, you know what, maybe he just had a bad day. Maybe he was in a cranky mood, and what he said, which was maybe not program, good program at all, was because he had a bad day, you know? And one of the things that we have trouble with down in our area, and it's always been a big controversy, and I think it is in a lot of places in LA, is reading the Lord's Prayer. You know, and I'll tell you, I had a hell of a prime. When I came in, I said to my first AA sponsor, look at that, you're reading the Lord's Prayer. That's a Christian prayer, and you shouldn't be reading that because we're not supposed to be affiliated with any. And he said, well, okay, let's look at the words, and you tell me what your problem is with this. And I like sputter, I go, it's not the words, it's the concept. And he said, John, we're not reading a concept, we're reading words. So what words do you have problems with in the Lord's Prayer? And all of a sudden I was like, okay, you know. And in AA meetings, every one of my AA meetings, we read the Lord's Prayer. And I understand some people don't like it for that concept thing. But one of my favorite lines in any prayer of any religion is, forgive us our trespasses as we would forgive others. You know, like I was saying about the guy who I would write off my list because he had a bad day. Well, the thing about forgive us our trespasses is if I want to get cut some slack for having a bad day, I got to be willing to cut other people's slack for having a bad day. And that took a long time to get that. And I want to see how much more of this I got. You know, and again, all of these things, these character liabilities, defense mechanisms, all that, again, it was about filling that God-shaped hole, right? And I didn't like the person I was. I didn't think I measured up. I'm not enough. So I've got to do all of these things to somehow catch up to the rest of you guys, you know? I would pump up my ego with things, and I would have to tell you how great I was about things. Or, you know, the thing I would do, I would lie for no reason whatsoever, you know? I would get a 98 on a test, and I had to come back and tell you I got a 99, you know. And I look back, what the hell was that about, you know? But it was about wanting, I'm still not enough, you know. Or I would have to go out of my way. I'd gossip about people. Why? Because by gossiping, I can feel myself superior to whatever it is I was gossiping about. Well, a person who likes himself doesn't have to go out and do those things to feel superior. And that's another one of those things I had to learn, you know. You know, as you get better and the more you get try and get rid of these character defects, it's what they call in technology a feedback loop. The more you do that's good and the more better you feel about yourself, the more you want to do good and feel better about yourself, you know. And, you know, it just takes a while, you know, to get all that. Yeah, and so actually, I got us out of order. So, but the other what it comes down to is developing compassion, firstly for myself, for being a human, and then for others because I start to think of them. You know, we're all just these kids that all of a sudden turn around and we're adults. And we, you know, and still in my head, I'm like, how the hell did that happen? You know? And to realize that nobody got the manual. I didn't get the manual that I, you know, and I used to think everybody got one, but they didn't either. We're all sort of muddling through and being human. And as it says in the big book about, you know, we step on other people's toes and they step on our toes. And the whole idea of the more we work on these character defects, the more we can accept the, you know, ourselves and each other, and that's where the serenity comes, you know. Anyway, I'm the end of the sixth step. I want to stop now because we should do some sharing and some ask it basket things. I want to leave time for sharing, and I realize I sort of screwed this up, so I may leave some of these until later. So I'm going to stop right now, and we'll let Lorianne come up and play Phil Donahue some more. Okay.